Hi, I'm Nick Rigoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. Hey everyone, we're on number 11 of Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, and something kind of different for today's episode. The person I'm interviewing isn't actually involved in the jiu-jitsu world in any way, but he is a very well-spoken, very intelligent martial artist. He's the author of two books that really captured my attention over the last couple of weeks. And while reading them, I just realized that I needed to get this guy on the show and that what he had to share would be valuable to you guys. So this is Scott Langley, a highly decorated karate instructor who spent a lot of time training in Japan and has a large organization of karate dojos. I hope you guys enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome back to episode 11 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, and something quite different today. It's our first non-Jiu-Jitsu guest. I say non-Jiu-Jitsu, but he is still a martial artist of great renown. It's a gentleman named Scott Langley, and he's the author of two books, which I picked up about a week or maybe 9 or 10 days ago, and I literally blasted through these books in less than 2 days. I could not put them down. And I said to myself, I got to get this guy on the show. You guys will enjoy hearing some of his stories. And I also wanted to ask him some questions and get some of his opinions on martial arts in general. So, Scott, thank you so much for coming on the show and giving us your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah. Scott, would you just tell our listeners a little bit about your background, in particular your background when it comes to martial arts?
Sure. Well, actually, I started martial arts aged 5. I started with jiu-jitsu.
No way.
Back in the day in Liverpool at the World Jiu-Jitsu Federation.
Okay.
Which I understand has mixed reviews at the moment in terms of the level and the standard. But when I was 5, it was great, and I started training there. But then my family moved away from Liverpool after a couple of years, and we end up in Yorkshire, and I started Shotokan karate properly when I was 11 years old.
Okay.
And I've been training nonstop since then, since 11, so for 33 years.
Wow, that's fantastic. I find it quite interesting because I actually started training karate when I was, I think, 6 or 7, because my dad was a karate instructor, a Shotokan instructor, actually. And then my path eventually took me down the jiu-jitsu road. So I think what one of the things that fascinates me about your story is that you went off to Japan to study or to attend. Well, it wasn't your original intention, but you ended up attending one of the instructor's courses that is renowned for being incredibly difficult, and apparently only 4 foreigners had ever made it through at that point when you arrived. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it was always my secret plan. I mean, I never verbalized it or told it to anybody, but in the back of my mind, that's what I found out about the instructor's course when I was like 14 or 15. Mm-hmm. And then I happened to meet one of the other British graduate of the instructor's course when I was 17, and I just felt that that's what I wanted to do. And so I went to Japan when I was 23 with the sole purpose really was to do the instructor's course. And I got it on it when I was 27.
Yeah. So, and I don't want to give too much away of the book. In fact, I'm going to be plugging this book a lot in future. I've already probably been responsible for about 10 sales of it over the last week, because I'm messaging my buddies and I'm like, you got to read this. You got to hear this. What was the biggest shock to you when you arrived as this instructor's course? You obviously had prepared yourself mentally and you knew that it was going to be difficult, but by all accounts, it seems like it was beyond anything you could have imagined.
Yeah. I mean, I'd already been in Japan for a couple of years, because you can't just arrive on the doorstep and say, I want to do it. Well, I mean, in fact, a few people have, and they've lasted a matter of days. I went and I was training full time at the headquarters in Tokyo for a good couple of years before I was asked to be take part, or asked to take the test to get onto the course. And so I had quite a lot of cultural understanding and certainly quite a lot of intensive training within Japan. But I think just the step up that you go from being a regular normal student in the dojo to kind of training on the instructor's course and training along with the instructors was such a massive leap that I just didn't know what had hit me. And very quickly I started to, suffer the consequences of that intense training and mentally how difficult it was to cope with and stuff like that. So yeah, nothing could prepare me for it. And I've given advice to people who have tried to get on it since then. And the advice is basically, you know, you can't really prepare for this. You just have to have a strong determination that you will survive. And I just did it one day at a time.
Yeah, just one day at a time. It's something I keep reminding myself about life in general. It's just taking one day at a time. So, yeah. You know, again, without giving away too much from the book, would you be able to share with us one of the more difficult or profound experiences that you had? It doesn't necessarily even have to be a difficult one. It could be an uplifting one, but there's so many in the book, and I'd just like to maybe like whet the readers or the listeners' appetites by having you relate one of the stories, maybe about an encounter with one of the instructors or one of the training camps or something like that. I think that would be fantastic.
Yeah, sure. I'll talk about Inada, who actually I give him a different name in the book, Sueki in the book. I changed the names to protect the innocent. But Sueki was a young guy who had just graduated from Teikyo University, which is the top karate university in Japan. And he went straight into the instructor's course. And he had, in the first 6 months of starting the course, he won the world championships, the 70 kilo plus world championships. So he was probably pound for pound one of the best fighters in karate, all styles karate at the time. And I met him during our test the first time, and he gave me a hard time, of course, but he was okay. He was kind of a good guy, and we had a few beers afterwards in the party. And I remember my Japanese wasn't so great at the time, but I remember sitting next to him, and he turned to me and he shook my hand. He says, "Promise," in his very bad English. It was worse than my Japanese. "Promise." And I was like, "Yakusoku, yakusoku shimasu," like, "let's promise." The idea was that we were going to finish this together. And over the course of the next 3 years, really, he became one of the most prominent competitors in the world, but was always there training next to me day by day. And we had this bond that, you know, you're a martial artist. I'm sure most people are listening are martial artists, that you only really kind of achieve to such a great level when you're sweating in the dojo. And for me, the friendship that we found in that dojo was in proportion to the hardship that we went through. And he was one of the toughest guys I know. And then it comes to my sayonara party, my leaving party, and he took me aside, grabbed me, and just started crying like I've never seen anyone cry in my life, saying, "Don't leave, don't leave, don't leave." And so for me, the hardship, the getting hit, the getting beaten, the, you know, the kind of crazy thought processes that I was going through is all kind of superficial stuff. And so, you know, I'm sure kind of people can read it and take from that what they want. But the true bond that I created with my doki, my same level, same year partner was truly, truly great.
You know, I'm so happy you related that story, because that was one of the most profound and touching parts of the book, is to when he eventually, at your leaving party, when he was crying like that, it really warmed my heart, because I didn't think that a person like that, under that set of circumstances, where you have to basically put on this front of being a tough guy and you're in this very strict hierarchical structure, the fact that he showed so much emotion made it all the more impressive and all the more touching. And I really appreciated that. It was a big surprise for me in the book, actually, that happened. It was a fantastic story.
Yeah.
That brings me.
I was going to say, sorry, I think it's really important. I think quite a lot of people say, you know, you should never meet your heroes because you'll be disappointed by that experience. But for me, because I was training alongside my heroes, and training alongside people that I'd looked up to for decades. But one of the things about meeting your heroes or being surrounded by those type of people is that you realize that they're normal. And for some people, that's kind of a letdown. But for me, it meant that, well, if they're normal and I'm normal, therefore I can be as good as them. And so for when Sueki did that, for example, and a whole load of other kind of situations through my time in Japan, I realized, well, there is no difference between me and them. And then I saw how hard they trained, and I thought, well, that's the only difference. So if I train as hard as that, I can be as good. So for me, that was a very liberating experience and took off the shackles of, certainly in Shotokan karate or karate per se, that Westerners often feel, well, we'll never be as good as the Japanese. Well, you know, I don't believe that for a second.
Yeah, I have a more specific question regarding that I'll ask in a minute, but I just...
Okay.
And again, that's tied into this other question that I'm about to ask, which is that, you know, Japan has been... I've been fascinated by Japan since I was a very little boy, and my dad was teaching me a little bit of karate, and then I just started doing judo, and I was taught about, you know, the Kodokan and the Budokan, and told that Jigoro Kano created judo and how he disseminated it across the world. And since then, that fascination with Japan further developed because I became a big video game nerd, and most of the best video games came from there. And I just always wanted to go. And in the last few years, I've been lucky enough to be able to visit Japan. And I always say to my buddies who are about to go there on vacation, I just say nothing can prepare you, because as I knew it was going to be strange, I knew it was going to be foreign, and I knew it was going to blow my mind, and it was still stranger and more foreign and blew my mind more than I could have possibly imagined.
Yeah.
And there's something that I had read about, I can't even remember where, but it's, and I'd heard the sentiment expressed before, that if you're a foreigner or a gaijin and you visit Japan, or even if you're born in Japan, you can do whatever you want to try to integrate into the society and become accepted and become viewed as an equal. But no matter what you do, you never will be. There's always this implicit subcurrent or undercurrent that, like, you are foreign. You could not possibly understand what it's like to be Japanese. You could not possibly really integrate into our society. And so you're always kept at a bit of an arm's length. And I guess what I wanted to ask you is, did you feel that your relationship with that gentleman had proven that to be incorrect, and that you'd actually overcome and been able to bridge that divide?
To a level, yes. I mean, I would certainly kind of agree with the fact that an awful lot of what people say about the inaccessibility of Japan. So, you know, I was only there for 5 years, but by the time I left, my Japanese was very good, and I never had any issues in terms of the language or culture. Yet I still would have people say to me, oh, well, you'll never understand martial arts. You know, I had one lady who was a friend of a friend. She was a rather rotund, large Japanese lady, unusually for Japanese ladies, who worked in an office, who practiced judo when she was like 10 years old for a year in junior high school or something. And she said, we were talking, and my friend had introduced me. It was all in Japanese, you know, my Japanese friend. And she said to me, oh yeah, but you'll never really understand martial arts. And I thought, you know, I've dedicated my life. I've left my family. I've left my friends. I've come to this very alien world and lived here for 5 years and bled and sweat on a dojo to truly deeply understand what I believe is martial arts. And some office lady who obviously hasn't exercised in years tells me that I don't understand it. But for her mind, it was completely justified because she was Japanese and it was inherent. And that's what they believe. But that's one level, and it's kind of you've been to Japan. There's no, in the West, there's I, and in the Japan, there's us. So the more East you go, it's much more of a collective thinking. So collectively, that's what they will think. Whereas individually, so my Sueki, my training partner, he can individually say, yeah, Scott knows what he's doing. Scott's a good guy. Scott's one of us. But collectively, the group mentality will go, oh no, but he's a foreigner, so therefore he'll never understand. So it's a bit of a cognitive dissonance where they have two kind of differing thought processes going through the mind at the same time, maybe.
Mm-hmm. It's tied into, you know, what the martial art that I practice and then most of my listeners will be practitioners of is quite a specific variant of jiu-jitsu called Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And yeah. One of my very good training partners once said to me that no matter what you do, you'll always be regarded as a second-class citizen by the Brazilians. Mm. And it got me to thinking, and I realized that that's probably what you have experienced in the karate world for a long time, is that it's, and the strange thing, it's not only the Brazilians that, oh, sorry, the Japanese that would regard you as a second-class citizen. I realized that you must have faced an uphill struggle as a teacher, because the average Westerner will automatically assume that because someone is Japanese, an instructor Japanese, they're better than you at teaching, or better able to disseminate or transfer their knowledge to you, or have some sort of intrinsic better understanding of the art. And I know that's something that I used to struggle with as well. Is I used to think, well, I used to get the kind of feeling that, like, look, no matter how well I apply myself, and no matter how well my lessons are prepared, and no matter how much I pour myself into this, and no matter what level of skill I attain, Joe Smith is always going to go to the seminar run by a Brazilian guy as opposed to me, because I could just hear in your voice now that you completely understand what I'm saying. Yes. Right?
And yeah.
Have you felt that the tide is turning when it comes to that? Like, have you noticed a change in the world of karate that people are starting to accept that, look, maybe it's not just your heritage that determines how well you can teach someone this art?
Well, like, I've always tried to, you know, I mean, I completely empathize and completely understand everything that you've just said and experienced it myself. But what I think is that as martial artists, you know, we're always trying to kind of draw strength from the challenges that we face. And so I've always thought, well, I will never be as technically good as some of the Japanese that I trained along with, because they had a whole system from the age of 5 right the way up until they completed the instructor's course at the age of 24, 25, say, that was geared for them, training, teaching, whatever they were doing, that got them to that point. Whereas, you know, I struggled in a regular kind of parochial dojo for a while before I could get anywhere semi-decent. So the point is that I'm making is that, like, they had all the advantages. So what am I going to do? Well, my idea was that I might not be world champion. I might not be able to beat them in sparring matches consistently, but I will make sure that my teaching is far better, because I earn a living by teaching Westerners, and I have a Western mentality, and I can conceptualize things similar to Westerners. So I've made sure that I can out-teach them and have concepts and principles and thematically driven classes that they would struggle for or struggle to produce. And then I also have a greater sense of first of all, I speak English fluently, which often, you know, they don't. And so I have that advantage. I have an understanding of how things work nowadays in terms of social media and how you can get your message across. And then the final realization is that with social media, with YouTube, with stuff like that, there is a democratization of the martial art world. So people can demonstrably see who is better. And if you put your stuff out there, people will judge you, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But if you've got a good message, a good idea, a unique standpoint, then people can see that very rapidly. And I think that's the advantage that I have within my field, that a lot of the, you know, my not rivals, but certainly the people that would be vying for the same sort of business or attention or students don't necessarily use that well.
Yeah, and so basically it could be summed up that the cream will always rise to the top, and the people are able to see that now, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. Mm. And something else that I wanted to ask you about, I mean, it might be a little bit of a touchy subject, but and I don't want to give away too much of the book, but and you can, I guess, fill in as much as you'd like to or wouldn't like to, but you dedicated yourself to this particular martial arts organization for a long time, and you did an extraordinary amount of work for them and built up their organization in Europe. And in the end, because of a series of perceived slights, which I don't even think were slights, they turned their back on you. And it's beyond even turning their back on you. They basically stabbed you in the back.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know, where do you stand on that now? How do you feel about that? Have you processed that? Is it completely, do you still hold any resentment, or how do you feel about where are you in your life when it comes to that at the moment?
Well, just to fill you in even more is that I obviously was, I was forced to leave the JKS, the Japan Karate Shoto Renmei, after, arguably doing a lot of work for them in Europe. And then I joined the WTKO, the World Traditional Karate Organization, who was headed up by that British guy who I met when I was 17, who I've known for 25 years. And I proceeded to, I think, do the similar thing for the WTKO within Europe. And then 4 months ago, he expelled me. So maybe it's me. Maybe I should just take a look at myself and go, you know what, Scott? If it happens once, it's probably their fault. If it happens twice, maybe it's my fault. These things happen. And in terms of processing it, a very good friend of mine, when I was recently expelled from the WTKO, a very good friend of mine said, you know, Scott, you'll be all right with the organizational aspect of it. So I've created my own group, the HDKI. Already we have 9 countries, nine international affiliates, and we're doing well. We're moving forward. And my friend said, you know, you'll do all right organizationally. It's the personal contact that you'll struggle with, and that's, she hit the nail on the head. You know, I don't struggle with the politics, because politics is just people's feelings, and if they feel slightly threatened, or they feel that they need to do this direction, that happens all the time. But it's the connections that I make with individuals and dojo heads and instructors and friendships that I create that are severed by people who are not part of that relationship. So someone at the top decides that they can no longer invite Scott Langley to their dojo. So lots of dojos then have to cancel me, but all those dojo heads are good friends of mine. So politically, organizationally, I'm fine. Pick myself up, dust myself off, and move forward in the way that I've been doing for the last 15 years. But personally, kind of having to say goodbye to people that I consider very good friends, that's the hard bit.
Yeah, I mean, that must be absolutely torturous. And when I say this, I'm really not trying to advertise anything, but that is the reason I created Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood, is because I saw a lot of that within the Jiu-Jitsu community. And I just realized how it just seems so stupid to me, the rivalries and the politics and all the structures. And I understand that what we're doing, martial arts, does require a little bit of a structure and some organization to be overlaid in order to keep, we're doing controlled, orchestrated violence, basically. And if there's no sort of guy with a big stick, I guess it could get out of hand. But just see some people, they take it so seriously, and I know certain individuals, and if I'm honest, I was probably one of those individuals in my early 20s, whereby if their instructor told them to jump in a fire, they wouldn't even think twice. Or if their instructor told them to go headbutt a telephone pole or whatever it may be, they'd do it. And if they said, okay, look, we don't talk to those people anymore, even though that one guy is one of your closest friends, then you just don't talk to that guy anymore. And I think, to me, I find that repugnant. And I think it has no place in modern martial arts. I mean, maybe years and years ago, but with the way the world is moving and the way like boundaries are dissolving between nation states, for one thing, I think that we've, as a species and as a race, we've kind of superseded that. And my personal understanding is that it's all rooted in fear. It's all rooted in fear and greed. And when someone senses that perhaps an instructor has something that he doesn't have, he becomes very jealous and very guarded, and he starts to close down, because where else could that come from?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, people who start martial arts, generally speaking, start from an insecurity. They want to be stronger. They want to be faster. They want to defend themselves. They want to be something other. They relate to that Japanese mentality, or they relate to something that is not themselves. Mm-hmm. And so that insecurity makes them start. The more insecure they are, the harder they train. The harder they train, the better they become. The better they are, the higher rank they become. The higher rank they become, the more likely that they're going to be in a position of power. And the more power they have a greater fear of losing that power, which then feeds back into the insecurity. So I think in many structured martial arts systems, it is a vicious circle that is creating this loop that promotes the insecure people to the top. And I think we have to guard against that. And I think there's maybe a new paradigm, almost like a different generation of instructors that are coming through that can stand on their own two feet and say, you know what, I'm actually quite secure. I don't have to force my students to kind of only train with me. And that can only be a good thing. And I'd argue the point that that is not a new thing, but it's maybe a return to the old, certainly in karate. Mm. Like I've visited Okinawa quite a few times, and in Okinawa, there is the Okinawan Karate Association, which is all styles, all groups, all under one branch. They all come together. They all train together. And it's like a community where you come and have a big community party, and then you go back to your own house. And in your own house, you have your family, whether that be extended or small, but you have your family, and that's your close-knit community. But then you can go on to the further community without feeling insecure that your family members would leave. So I would argue that maybe it's a return to how martial arts should be, rather than this highly structured, highly business-like, manufactured organizations that have sprung up since maybe Second World War.
Wow, Scott, I mean, you put that really, really well. I appreciate that insight. I mean, the next question, when I ask it, I ask it with from a position of total respect, and I do not mean to offend in any way. You can not answer it if you choose not to.
Okay.
So how did the advent of the UFC and mixed martial arts, did they make you question anything with regards to karate and the fact that you were doing such a traditional system? Did it make you look at karate in a different way? Did it make you start cross-training in any other arts? Can you just tell me what you thought when that came about?
I didn't feel that I wasn't particularly, I know a lot of instructors who became very insecure about it. And like, I know my karate works. And I know that there are great, kind of gaps within that skill set. You know, I'm basically standing on my two feet, kicking, punching. And if it goes to the ground, then I'm not that good. So do I want to kind of investigate trying to build up that kind of aspect of my art? Well, no, not really. I do a little bit. I do a little bit of kind of cross-training in that sense. And I certainly watch a lot and see how that can be applied to what I do. But I also think, you know, everything is everything. At some point, we are just merely learning how to use our body. Mm. And trying to produce the most efficient form from our body. So if I take that as a way of training, then I don't have much problem reproducing what other people do. So I'll give you an example. I was teaching in Norway a couple of months ago, and there was a karate instructor who's also a very good Aikido instructor. And I was teaching something, and he said, "Oh, you can try doing it this way." And he showed me, and I was like, okay, I like that. And so he did it on me, and I did it, and I did it well. And he says, you know, in Aikido, that's called the 20-year throw. You have to be doing Aikido 20 years to get that throw. And I did it first time after feeling him do it to me. And I think if you're studying how your body works, body mechanics, biomechanics, then everything does become everything. So I don't then get insecure when someone does something that I'm not necessarily training, because I know that I could pick it up if I wanted to. That's half of the answer. The other half of the answer is that for me, I do Budo, like martial art or martial way. So it's a martial art. So I want to become a martial artist. I don't want to practice a martial art. And that artistic nature is the balance between form and function. And so I'm constantly trying to make sure that my form has function. But I'm also trying to make sure that my function has form. And I'm trying to make sure that I have complete balance. And for me, karate is enough to constantly try to hone and refine and polish those techniques that we practice. And hopefully, I will never be in a fight. I don't want to fight. So I avoid being in a position where someone's going to throw me to the ground. I never need that.
Man, Scott, there's so much in that that resonated with me. In particular, when you said you want your form to have function, your function to have form. One of the greatest of all time jiu-jitsu practitioners, a guy called Hickson Gracie, he said once that it's not enough just to be able to beat someone. You have to be able to look good while doing it. And that always stuck with me. And when you watch the guy, there's a sort of grace that enlivens his movements. He's not just a brute, even though he's an incredibly tough guy. The way he moves is just, it is, you can see the form within it. And that's something I've always tried to bring to my personal practice of jiu-jitsu as well, is realize that, because jiu-jitsu is slightly different in other martial arts, in that if you watch it, it doesn't look very visually appealing to the untrained person, or to someone who doesn't know what's going on. It just looks like two guys like hugging each other, basically. But I think that I just took away so much from what you just said. I really, really appreciate that. And I have just one more question before I let you go. If you had to discuss or give some wisdom to the young Scott Langley, the maybe 18-year-old Scott Langley, before he embarked upon this journey to Japan, in order to better prepare him for what he was about to go through, what would that be?
I don't know if I would say anything, because I think one of my strengths is to be completely naive. And I think right up until the point where, you know, someone is punching me really hard in the face, I'm thinking, well, this won't happen. Surely, how bad can it be? And convincing myself that, you know, this will be fine. And then I get punched in the face really hard. And then it's over, because pain is fleeting. And then I can say to myself, sure, it wasn't that bad. So I think, you know, preparation in a terms of a mental preparation can be a bit overstated. I think denial is a great thing. And certainly I had this, I mentioned cognitive dissonance, where I had the back of my mind, I knew it was going to be really bad. But the front of my mind, the bit of my mind that got me up in the morning and made me walk to the dojo, that was constantly saying, sure, it'll be grand, as they say in Ireland. So I think having that attitude is quite important. I think taking not only one day at a time, but one hour at a time, one second at a time, you know, I think is really super important. And thinking, well, if I've just done that day, I can do the next, and just doing that every single day, and just having a vision of what I wanted. So right the way through the instructor's course, I had a vision of living in Dublin, teaching full time and enjoying my karate. And for the last 15 years, I mean, I'm from Liverpool in England originally, but I've been living in Dublin. I have a full time dojo. I teach all over the world, and this is exactly what I wanted. So having the grit and determination to keep that image in your mind of what you wanted or what you want, and at the same time convincing yourself that it'll be fine, that, you know, you're not going to die in this, and you'll get through it.
Yeah, that's great. This is going to make this podcast sound a little bit disjointed, but I should have I brought this up in the earlier part when you're discussing the body mechanics. I watched a couple of your YouTube videos of you demonstrating certain techniques, and I mean, I don't really know much about karate. It's been decades since I did it, and I didn't take it to a very high level. But I was absolutely astounded to see you were demonstrating a certain kata and a certain principle involved in that kata. And I was like, God damn, man, this is instantly transferable to jiu-jitsu, instantly. And I just that blew my mind, because for a long, long, long time I've blocked off any study of traditional martial arts because I just thought, okay, there's too much form, not enough function, and it won't be applicable to what I'm doing. But after seeing you do that, I just thought maybe I need to reassess, and I don't know, maybe have you kick the shit out of me with some karate one day and head over to Ireland.
With pleasure, as long as you don't jump on me and make force me to tap out within seconds.
Scott, man, what a great pleasure it's been to speak to you. If our listeners want to get their hands on your books, which are Karate Clever and Karate Stupid, and I again not getting anything for this endorsement, I got to tell you, those are fantastic books, and you'd be
Thank
a
you.
fool not to read them if you're listening. Where should they go if they want to find out more about your dojo?
They're available on Amazon or any they're on Kindle or anywhere where you can buy a book, they're available.
Okay, great. And your dojo, if people wanted to train with you.
Yeah, so I teach full time in Dublin. We have a full time dojo in Ranelagh in Dublin, South Dublin, and they can go to the hdki.org, which is the worldwide organization, but it will lead you to my dojo in Dublin, but it's hdki.org.
Okay, great. Scott, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Man, I feel so charged up after speaking to Scott. It's the strangest thing, I don't want to say I've had a disdain for karate and traditional martial arts, but if I'm honest, I kind of have over the last 20 years since I've been training in grappling and jiu-jitsu and some of the more dynamic, real world focused martial arts. I was kind of a bit upset when I realized that the stuff I'd been learning as a kid probably wasn't going to work in specific encounters, or wasn't as functional as I hoped. And it kind of left a bad taste in my mouth when it came to traditional martial arts. And until reading these books of Scott's recently, I'd still held that kind of resentment and that almost, I don't want to say ill feeling, but just not good vibes towards traditional martial arts. And after reading his books, and in particular, watching the guy on YouTube and realizing that he and I had a lot in common, and that even though our respective martial arts were quite different, they were also very, very similar. And I just had so much respect for what this guy went through for his art and for what he was doing and what he believed in. It made me question things and realize that I'd actually been a bit of a closed-minded dickhead when it came to things like that. And I just really appreciate how willing he was to share with us what he went through, in particular in the books. The books are far more intense than the conversation we just had. I cannot recommend these two books enough, Karate Stupid and Karate Clever. And I'm just happy and grateful to be able to talk to people like this, and just really enjoying the podcast at the moment. And I'm looking forward to the next show. Trying to get my coach Roger Gracie on. I know he just bashed up Bushesha in that amazing match less than a month ago, and I just thought it would be great to talk to him about some of that, including his preparation and his mindset for that. So hopefully we'll have him on soon. And until next time, guys, keep the faith and keep training smart.